Hello and welcome to Tools in the Shed, a podcast powered by Cars Guide, ready to rip into car stuff that's caught our eye this week. I'm Cars Guide Deputy Editor James, and with me is our Adventure Editor, Crafty.
Morning.
And key contributor, Chesto.
Chesto.
Chesto. This week, we're rounding up everything we know so far about the next generation 300 series Land Cruiser and the all-in brawl surrounding runout of the outgoing 200 series.
Less exciting.
We'll discuss a trio of recent entries to the Cars Guide Garage, and we'll catch up with Tesla's new Techno King, that's his job title, and juvenile tweeter-in-chief in this week's Muskwatch. So stay with us. But we have something of an alignment of the planets in that our cast for the podcast this week, Chesto, has been the most prolific generator of Land Cruiser news content in the history of humankind. And, of course, Crafty is Australia's unquestioned and unrivaled Land Cruiser, Sven Gali. He can make them do things they don't know they can do.
That's right.
So he's very
well placed.
I don't
even know what that means, but I know it makes me feel uncomfortable and yet excited at the same time.
So it's a what we know so far wrap of the Land Cruiser 200. So 300,
alert.
Beg your pardon.
Spoiler alert, we know heaps.
We know heaps. And so, look, Chesto, without further ado, we've got various, territory to cover about timing, about the scale of this new machine, what's going to drive it. Take it away. Let's get started.
Well, I'll take you back to the very beginning of the LC300 story, and that was when news broke out of Japan that it'd be offered with two petrol engines, a twin-turbo V6 from a Lexus and then a hybrid version of that same engine. And, of course, that got people in Australia very nervous because there was no talk of a diesel. And worse, you know that we've had petrol Land Cruisers in the past and, in fact, cut those engines from the lineup because people don't want them. They want a diesel. And there was lots of hand-wringing and an outpouring of grief for the demise of the V8 diesel we've got in this country that everybody loves. Look, unfortunately, I can tell you that engine is gone. It will not appear in the new model under any circumstances. However, in better news, we will get a diesel. So about two or three months after that talk of petrol engines, talk of the diesel engine finally broke. We know that it's going to be a 3.3-litre, six-cylinder diesel engine. For bonus points or top trump cards, it will also appear in other Toyota products, given it's a new engine for the brand.
Right.
To buy other products, you can look to a GR Hilux to also.
And so, Chesto, it's one turbocharger then?
I believe so, yeah. So details on that engine, I must admit at this point, are relatively slim.
Relatively skinny. Okay, yep.
We do not know its outputs yet, but we do know that Sean Hanley, who's the sales and marketing chief at Toyota in Australia, and frankly, just a very big hitter in the Toyota organization, has promised us hand on heart that it will outperform the current V8 LC200 Land Cruiser in every conceivable way, from capability to power and torque and towing. So everything your current LC200 can do, they promised the new LC300 will do, despite losing a couple of cylinders.
So if it is inferior in any particular aspect, what is Sean Hanley agreed to do? Will he eat his hat or he's going to do the nudie run around the... Oh, yeah?
Promise to take a drive with our Land Cruiser, Sven Gali.
He'll be thrashed publicly, mate, in the nude.
Nice one.
But anyway, so look, very exciting. The car is coming. I'll be honest, there is a lot of pushback from the Land Cruiser community in Australia who love the current car and don't want to change it. And frankly, the sales of that car reflect it. There's a real rush on that vehicle. People try to secure one before the new one gets here. But again, I'm going to revert to Toyota in Australia and say that their argument is that has always been the case with Land Cruiser. And Crafty, I'm sure you'll remember this as well. Every time they release a new Land Cruiser model, the aficionados go, oh, it's going to be crappy and it was the one we've got and it won't be able to perform and you're ruining the brand. Then fast forward 2 years into that model's life cycle and everyone says, well, you can't do another one. This one's the best one we've ever had.
I could draw a line there to the sports car, world and talk about the Porsche 911.
Yeah.
But everyone thinks the next one's not going to be as good as the one that's around right now. Yeah.
Absolutely. We're always going to get our traditionalists, having a verbal vomit. So, yeah.
And look, the cold, hard reality is that the day of the V8 engine, if it's not over already, that end is fast approaching. So, we're all going to have to get used to
it. It's undeniable, though, not to linger too long on the current one, but sales of that LC200 have been up month on month and year on year. It does feel like people are trying to get in and buy a V8 Land Cruiser before they can't anymore.
So it kind of a perfect storm there, actually, JC. I definitely, look, they've been up and then up and then up again. In fact, I think this year they're up another 27% or something, which is ridiculous because they had one of their best years in ages last year. So to continue that growth this year is pretty impressive. I think 50% of that is definitely people wanting to secure an LC200 while they still can. But it's also that perfect storm of pandemic and lockdown and not being able to travel
over. Domestic holidays.
People looking to go around the country and tow something. And we all know the LC200 is a pretty good option for that. So Prado sales are up as well, for example.
But there's you know, rumour of alleged jiggery-pokery around the Toyota retail network of some pretty handsome prices being asked for Land Cruisers.
Yeah, I mean, it's rare for a vehicle to become a collector's edition while it's still on new. Sale, essentially. But
on a boat.
Yeah. There are outrageous numbers coming out of dealerships and, in fact, off car sale websites, you know, like Auto Trader, et cetera, people getting, you know, asking ridiculous prices for LC200s now. The reason for that, I think, is because it is we now have strong evidence out of Japan that the bell, if it hasn't tolled for LC200, you'll hear it ringing shortly because the new model is set for reveal in April. So we're only a couple of weeks away now from seeing the LC300 in all its glory. In fact, Japanese media are quoting on the record Toyota dealers saying, we'll know spec, pricing, launch timing, engine capacities, etc. next month. So weeks away now.
Great. Is that early April, mid-April? What's the indicator?
April, my friend, April.
So long as it's not April 1.
Yeah, correct. So then, but the flip side of that is, again, those same dealers in Japan are saying that the only thing the factories are doing now for LC200 is completing orders that have already been made. The order books are officially shut on that model. Now, we've spoken to Toyota in Australia who say that's not officially the case here. They won't go on the record and say that the books are closed, but reading between the lines there, LC200 fans, if you want one in your driveway, make haste because, if you can still get one now, we don't know how much longer you will be able to get one for.
I think some dealers are setting up a Mad Max style Thunderdome cage
so
customers can actually have a cage fight to determine who gets the car.
That's right. Or just throw big duffel bags of cash at them. That's the other option.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. All right. And now the other thing that occurs to me is its size. We know that it's going to be a bit larger than an already pretty substantial vehicle.
Yes.
You've got, like, it's going to be 20 millimetres. Okay, that's not much. But when you're building up a big car, it's 20 millimetres longer.
Yep.
It's a fraction wider, just 5 mil. It's a little lower, 20 millimetres lower. And the wheelbase is creeping up towards 3 metres. So it's 50 millimetres longer in the wheelbase. I don't know about you, but whenever I sit next to a Land Cruiser 200 in traffic, I'm just looking up like the sun is about to be blocked out. It's already a big thing and it's going to be even bigger.
But, mate, I actually wrote a story on the new one not so long ago about why it was actually in response to the rush on LC200. And the story was basically, you know, why are you rushing into this vehicle before you've seen the LC300? Because there are other things we know about it too. It's going to be, it'll ride on the TNGA platform or a version of it, which has impressed in almost every other iteration Toyota's used it in. In fact, has impressed in every other iteration, not almost.
Yep.
It will actually be a modern car. And like, you know, as much as we love the old one, it just isn't. You know, this one's going to have a big infotainment screen. It's going to have CarPlay and Android Auto. It's going to have all the safety tech, all the entertainment tech that you expect from a modern car. And at this point, there's no reason to suspect that it will be any less capable than the vehicle it replaces. And it will still be powered by a punchy diesel engine, albeit one with two less cylinders. So it will be, I suspect, it will be a better all-round car across the board.
And that's, I mean, just to reiterate, that's something Sean Hanley, he's been running from that script for some time now, hasn't he? And he's super confident, long-time Toyota person in Australia.
Yep.
And he says that it's an iconic model that will be better in every possible way. And he's 100% confident that it's going to be terrific.
Correct. In fact, I think he said something along the lines of every Land Cruiser we've ever done has improved the Land Cruiser story, and this one will be no different. It will redefine the benchmarks again. But again, even if you just take capability out of it, if you take towing and everything else, just from an actual driving perspective, it's going to be more comfortable, more safe or safer, more technologically advanced and have better equipment than the car it replaces. I mean, it's worth at least waiting to see what it is before we write it off.
That's true.
And Toyota has been guilty in the past, as we know, dragging the chain with things in terms of safety and you know, multimedia systems and that sort of stuff. And the thing is, JC, I think what we've all got to remember too is now four-wheel drives, all-wheel drives, SUVs, whatever your phrase, whatever your preferred phrase is, they're all becoming so car-like. And I mean, hence the lower, longer, you know, wider. It's going to drive, you know, even more nicely than the current one, which drives pretty well. And I mean, we've towed big, large 3-ton caravans with that cruiser with the 200 patrol and all that sort of thing. And as a towing vehicle, as a towing platform, it's great.
Yeah. Yep.
But the lower, longer, wider, taller thing, it sort of goes against the grain of four-wheel drive capability, because then you're looking at angles like approach, departure and ramp breakover angles, that sort of thing. And even little changes, like minor changes in measurement, affect the, you know, affect the dimensions and affect how you deal with a tight bush track or steeper terrain and that sort of thing. Mm. But like Chesto says, I mean, we're always going to have people upset, you know, at a new generation of vehicles, at a smaller capacity engine, you know, and a perception of, you know, less power and less torque, even if that's not the case in pure cold hard figures. It'll be interesting to see further down the track, Chesto, a hybrid. Like, I think that's another thing people are really itching for, is a really good, solid, effective, efficient off-road hybrid.
Yeah.
Something that, with the driving range.
And Crafty, because they have made noises before, and in fact are almost certainly working on diesel hybrids. But from your perspective, would a petrol hybrid cruiser work in Australia? Would people buy a petrol-powered cruiser again if it was a hybrid?
People would, but I mean, the thing at the moment, the problem at the moment we have, and again, it might be a perception thing, especially if you consider, you know, if you take on a trip and you consider your points where you can charge up and that sort of thing, driving range is the big sort of obstacle for people to get over, in a mental sense, because they think, well, it's not going to, you know, I'm not going to have somewhere to charge it. I'm only going to be able to go 200, 300 Ks. If I'm towing something, you know, I'm going to have to think about a really close, you know, charge point, somewhere to charge. And I mean, and that comes with more infrastructure. And at the moment we just don't have it. And I mean, you know, as well as I do, that's something, that we need to, you know, the government needs to get on top of and really expand that network, because that at the moment is people's sort of.
I think it's critical you mentioned towing, Crafty, because I know it's very it's close to home for you. You have the special consignments coming in. I know there's that Cove where you have deliveries on a regular basis and you have
to. Yeah, well, that's you know, that's on the low, mate, as the kids say. So just keep that quiet. Yes. With the recreational powders, yes, let's
put it this way: you need all the towing power that.
Of course, for sure.
But Toyota has been for literally decades on a mission to make hybrid mainstream, and now the demand, they're reaping the benefits. You know, people are falling over themselves to buy a hybrid RAV, hybrid Corolla. They're all going gangbusters. Scaling it up into something like a Land Cruiser seems like a logical next step, and maybe is a workaround for those range anxiety things when you're talking full electric. So it would have a lot to recommend it.
Yeah, well, that RAV4 hybrid is unreal. I mean, that's the only Toyota on the new platform that I've driven, and I've taken it off-road, but it's a great thing to drive, and on that design platform, and you can understand why that is where everything is going. But in terms of capability, I think it's a deeper issue, because you're going to have to think about, well, where do I compromise? Do I overcome all those compromises in the aftermarket? And we've got an awesome aftermarket industry here, and they're always ready, you know, they're ready to jump on a new vehicle, especially a 300. I mean, I'm sure they're in early, you know, with their
they've got the blueprints and the CAD files and all that. Yeah.
So, you know, there are compromises you make when you buy a vehicle standard, but then you can easily overcome them and quickly with the aid of our wonderful aftermarket industry. So that's not a deal breaker. I mean, it may be for some. I mean, they may look at it and go, well, it's just a road going, you know, car, basically. I'm not interested. I'll look elsewhere. So,
right. But I mean, that's an interesting point you make, the road going thing. Chesto, there was whispers around a GR version. Yeah. So, you know, here's the Land Cruiser with a road focus, 100%, well, not 100%, but well and truly. What's your latest mail on the potential for that?
Well, let me throw a couple of one other very important caveat out there for anyone in the queue for LC300, and that is that an April reveal in Japan does not equal an April launch in Australia.
No, that's so true. That is true.
To be totally honest, that abundantly clear.
Yeah, so Toyota has kept...
Yeah, essentially, what we're saying is Japan is not Australia.
Correct.
Yes.
And we will see the car. An April, again, an April reveal in Japan doesn't necessarily mean an April launch in Japan either, as we know. They tend to drip feed these things out. But I guess the critical point is Toyota in Australia has not confirmed when that car will launch. We would suspect once it's revealed, it shouldn't be too much longer. Like we would say, I would estimate third or fourth quarter this year for an Australian launch, because once the car's out there and a car as iconic as a Land Cruiser, they're going to want it here as quickly as they can. But we don't know that exactly. So if you are in the queue, you might see it next month, but you certainly won't be able to buy it next month.
Well, I think historically Toyota Australia has had a reasonable voice with the factory relative to the volumes we sell. You know, America is the big deal, but we get a pretty good hearing. Australia gets a pretty good hearing, it would seem.
Mate, there are two. So I was speaking again to Sean Hanley about this. Basically, if you think of a table for every, there's a table for every model. The two biggest seats for Australia, perhaps unsurprisingly, are Hilux and Land Cruiser.
Gotcha. Yes, of course.
The brand here. But anyway, GR Land Cruiser. Now, you'll know that Australia, we do have facilities here to make those sort of changes to the vehicle. So we make things like, if you remember the Rogue Hilux. Yeah. They were Australian builds and designs. And in fact, some of those designs were then taken on internationally, which is pretty cool too. Yeah. And so what Toyota in Australia is saying is there's absolutely no reason why those same Australian facilities couldn't turn their attention to the new Land Cruiser. Now, they arguably wouldn't do it initially because they'll want to bed the car in first and get those early sales out of the way. But around a sort of midlife, which for a model like a Land Cruiser can be anywhere between 10 and 150 years, they might re-spark some interest by doing some locally designed special editions, one of which could include a GR model. Now, unlikely to mean more power because it would obviously retain the diesel engine. And with a car's off-road focus as the Land Cruiser already, you would suspect it to go more down the on-road performance style, suspension changes, those kind of things.
Yeah. I mean, all you have to do is look at, in the premium end of the market, the rise of AMG SUVs, coupe SUVs, all of that has evolved into a thing. Toyota would be looking at that and thinking that there's some potential. And they did do the local Rogue and Rugged X and all of that stuff. What do you make of that, Crafty?
Are we sort of talking about the prospect of a Land Cruiser 300 Rugged X or a Land Cruiser 300 Ultimate?
Yeah, I'd say the prospect's pretty likely, or even a GR performance type.
Yeah, I think we can just assume so, because you said, that's just the way the world's going. And I mean, you think, you know, every time I think that they've, you know, they're sort of fulfilling a niche within a niche within a niche, they come up with another one. So
they're just stuffing each niche.
Yeah.
I think you know, car manufacturers, if you're not making something for every sort of type of individual and every type of car buyer, then you're not in the game, are you? And that's every little sort of pigeonhole.
Which has got to be a nightmare from a product planning point of view and from an inventory point of view. When you think about the complexity of various brands' model ranges now, you know, lots and lots of models, lots and lots of variants and trim levels, and on it goes. Yes, you can answer all of those niches, but your volume for each of those cars isn't necessarily enormous. And it just must be a head scratcher from time to time on what you're ordering, what you're holding in stock, what the customers want. It's all got to be so complicated.
Well, we seem to just continuously redefine how much people are willing to pay for things. If I'm being totally honest with you, I'm still staggered at the money some utes command now.
Oh, of course. Yeah, no, absolutely.
You can virtually sit in a six-figure ute. That was something that was virtually unheard of, you know?
True. Yeah, and that's the evolution of the ute, isn't it? It's been profound.
And it's a case of for better or worse, Chesto, because I think they range from very superficial, things, yeah, like stickers absolutely. And a few other sort of, you know, seemingly after, you know, afterthoughts through to, you know, really well sort of aftermarket spec'd vehicles, yeah, you know, with a nudge bar and a light bar and, you know, things that are, you know, proper rock sliders.
Well, I mean, Crafty, you're sitting in front there in front of Les Hiddens, and I know there was also a Crafty version of the Land Rover. It was a short-lived limited edition Land Rover Crafty, but they're much sought after in the
there was a built-in beer coaster and can opener. And one with a disco ball, but that was very short-lived. So
the beer opener was on the driver's side. I was
which we came up against some legal.
Those disco balls are pulling big money on eBay. I must say.
Yeah. Can I bore you with one more Land Cruiser thing?
And there's never
enough Land Cruiser stuff, mate. Not from you, just
no. I'm again kind of parroting Sean, Mr. Hanley here again, but. Yep. His argument is that, and an argument I totally support, I must say, is that the idea of measuring performance by cylinder count is old. It's done.
It's outdated, isn't it?
And I mean, if anyone has driven the GA Yaris, for example, it's got a tiny little engine the size of a tennis shoe.
Three pots.
Absolute monster. It's unreal. Even that kind of thing was unheard of. So whatever they do with that car, whether it's six cylinders, the twin turbo, the hybrid, I'm very confident it will.
Well, think about Hilux with a four-cylinder turbo diesel. You know how successful it is in terms of sales and also its performance.
It's 3.5 ton, isn't it? The Hilux now.
I think so. I'm not 100% sure, but I think so.
Yeah, braked in a little 2.8 four-cylinder. So it's I mean, that's another prime example.
Yeah, but also the thing is, you know, you look at 2 liters. You look at the Everest, the Ranger, Raptor.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know, even things like, you know, an all-wheel drive, like an Amarok or something like that. Well, there are still question marks over all of those smaller capacity engines in terms of long-term reliability and performance, especially if they're being used as hardcore towing platforms. You know, on face value, they do really well, over the short term. And the anecdotal evidence is that, even after a couple of years, they're still good vehicles, nice to drive, comfortable, refined.
Yeah.
And the smaller capacity engine is not a problem.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. All right. Well, that's a pretty good rundown on what we know so far. And we also know that things are close.
And that's the end of the podcast. Thanks,
Jeff. That's it. Great. Well, thanks, Scott. No, it would be, we're still in a bit of not a limbo land, but we're still arm wrestling with YouTube. So we'll be posting this video to our website. And of course, the audio podcast continues on as usual. So it'd be great to hear from you in terms of whether you're a current 200 series owner, whether you're a prospective 300 series owner, where you stand and what kind of decisions you're making. That'd be great to hear from you. Comments at carsguide.com.au if you want to email us. So join the conversation.
Whether you may have bought Les Hiddens Parenti that's in this photo.
Like exactly. There. Or a Crafty. Whether you've got one of the very rare mirror balls.
The disco ball limited edition.
Disco ball.
Yes. There are only two of them. Which suits,
a Crafty special edition. I'd like to know what your favourite feature of that vehicle is.
Yes, that's true. Yes, there are some that are best not spoken about during daylight hours.
There's.
Right. Well, from there, that's a really good wrap-up. Thanks heaps, Chesto. And from there, we'll move to our garage. And Crafty, I want you to tell us about this vehicle. Its name sounds like a kind of bonnet drama from out of the BBC. tell us about the Avida Busselton.
The Avida Busselton.
And well, you've been in.
Yeah, well, we actually took this away for 3 or 4 days of camping. It's a motorhome, so it's massive, JC, basically. Not my usual sort of test vehicle, but we had a lot of fun. It turned out to be surprisingly easy to drive and steer around. It's almost 8 meters long.
Wow.
Wide. I mean, it's a motorhome, so, you know.
Is it a motorhome that's kind of custom from the ground up, or it's based on something? What's it built on?
There are three in the new C series range, and they're all based on an Iveco.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So an Iveco chassis, and that's obviously got the four cylinder turbo diesel. engine. And there are three. We had the largest one.
Great.
The designation is, just bear with me, it's C7544SL. And that means...
Wow, that's got a ring to it. That's very
that really
catchy.
Rolls off the tongue. But that's the only one of the three where from the inside of the motorhome, when you're stationary, you can hit a button and the right-hand side of the motorhome extends out.
Awesome.
It's unreal. It's like something out of the A-Team. It's incredible.
Great.
So you make sure, obviously, everything on the right-hand side, you're clear because it extends out. I don't know the exact measurements, but probably half a meter or something.
Or if you don't like your neighbours at the caravan park, you can just extend straight into
You can extend it so it knocks their tent over, which I did. Or one of their annoying kids.
Make a statement,
But unreal. At first, when I picked it up, again, it's not my usual cup of tea. But it's got everything on board, and Chesto, you know, I think even you'd be satisfied with the facilities on board. It's got a shower and a toilet at the rear. It's got a double bed inside the motorhome.
Awesome! Wow,
nice double bed. The C series are called such because they are bed over cabin models. So there's a double bed over the cabin, but that's really for kids.
Can you drive it from that double bed, or you? You have
I did try. and unreal. And I mean, especially in these times when we're all about domestic tourism and you know, sort of seeing our own country, which we should be all the time anyway.
Yeah.
Before you head overseas, I reckon. It is a house on wheels and surprisingly easy to steer around. And you've got to also, I've just got to make mention because there are so many features on it. I'd be here for a 3-hour podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
But of note, it has a microwave. It has a cooker. So you've got an induction hot plate. Yeah, two gas hot plates and an induction hot plate.
Sauna.
It's got a fridge, freezer, sauna, tennis courts, a gymnasium. and a Pilates studio, which I found surprising.
What about though on the freeway, Crafty? did you hit a kind of aero wall where you started to feel the
thing. Yeah, well, that's the thing, because my experience sort of driving motorhomes or spending any time in them is extremely limited. But no, it doesn't feel like a house on wheels. Every now and again, like we went through some high wind areas. Because JC, you'd eaten some beans.
Beans, thank you. I was waiting for that.
No, we went. good old dad joke. But we went through some high wind areas where the tall side of it, I think it's, again, bear with me, it's about 3 meters high, exterior height. So it would catch a gust of wind every now and again, but nothing, you know, nothing terrible, nothing. You know, if you've towed a caravan, a decent sized caravan or anything like
that. You're well practiced to driving up on two wheels anyhow, correct?
That's correct.
So if it went there, you're fine.
Yeah. So one hand was on the steering wheel, one hand was on the disco ball, adjusting that for my occupants.
Oh, that's good. So did you, when you went away with the family, did you make camp and stay there for a couple of nights, or you moved around as you were on holiday?
No, well, we moved around, but it's all pretty easy to set up. It's got an awning on the side, so if you're going to stop and stay where you are, you can set up the awning. It's pretty easy to set up and put down.
Great.
The only thing that was a little bit of an issue with this, and again, you get used to it as the days go on, was that it is a big beast, and if you've got to reverse into a tiny spot, or you've got to get through a sort of treed area, like the campsite we were at was quite heavily treed, so the trees were hanging right over the track, and the concern is there because it's so tall, you're going to collect branches on the way. But with a little bit of considered driving and you know, perhaps a chainsaw, I didn't say that, you can get through without any problems. So, but we had a ball. I mean, I took my family. We all had a ball. It's very comfortable. Again, it's not my cup of tea, but I can see a lot of people would like that.
Three questions without notice, Crafty. Question one, double bed inside. Is there any other bedding for the rest of the fam?
There's the double bed inside. And if you were listening, mate, there's a bed over the cabin.
So I gotcha.
The photos will illustrate that to our listeners. Second question.
Wasn't listening. This might have also been in there.
That's right.
What's the damage on this bad boy?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, and I don't know exactly. It's about 100. I think in my story I have said, because our test vehicle had a couple of additional things that are cost extras. But it starts at about 170 grand.
Yep.
Ours, I think, crept up to a little bit over 190 grand. But to get the full details, Chester, I'm sure you'll read my yarn at CarsGuide.com.
But then you've got the
so
optional.
not cheap at all. But it's all there. And I mean, you can free camp. It's got gas on board. You've got a couple of gas bottles.
That's cool.
It's got a battery of its own, obviously, as well as the battery for the vehicle. And you can adjust, you can select which power source you're using. Mm-hmm. You can use the gas for cooking and you've got hot water and all that
hot
sort of
water.
Stuff.
Yeah.
You've got grey awesome. Water tanks, you've got a water tank and all that sort of stuff. So, and as I found out, it's quite easy to empty the toilet canister. I was a bit worried about, getting splashed with stuff, but no. And it's all... again, I can see the appeal of something like this.
How it's frowned upon to return, and I guess a peek behind the curtain for all the listeners. We obviously take press cars. That's how we get access to all these vehicles. And it's a bit uncouth to return a press car empty or dirty or anything like that.
Yes.
Is it equally uncouth to return this thing with a full canister? Is that frowned upon?
Well, I didn't. I just thought it was. It was a bit of a common courtesy. I emptied it before I went, and we also cleaned it and stuff like that. It's a bit. I will say it's a bit difficult to keep clean because you're obviously kids are traipsing off the beach, and if there's a bit of rain, then there's wet grass and all that sort of stuff in. So it's one of those things.
Your family's half feral anyway, Craft.
Well, that's right.
You'd be bringing in the carcass to kind of butcher it after you've. You've been out there.
Well, the kids wouldn't sleep inside. They didn't see the point of sleeping inside somewhere dry and comfortable. So I put them outside.
Good man.
Okay.
Mate, last question before we move off this.
Last question.
I bloody love these things. So I am genuine. But I've always wanted to go across the States in one. Hence the reason I'm asking all these questions. What about that little four-cylinder engine? This thing must weigh several tons, surely. Multiple tons. How does the engine go dragging it around?
Yeah, it does. It's got a, I don't know the curb weight, Chesto, but it's got a GVM of 4.5 ton, and it can tow 3.5. But yeah, it's not insubstantial. You feel its weight every now and again. But otherwise, it's pretty easy to steer around. It's got plenty of, the throttle response is pretty good.
Really?
I mean, the Iveco. That it's built on, is a good thing. So you throw that on top. And the thing is, Iveta really take care in sorting out, everything on board and the finer details, and the construction is top notch, the build quality and the fit and finish. So you can see where the money goes. It is a lot of money, but you can see where every dollar goes.
Gotcha.
So,
cool. Yeah. All right, that's brilliant. Thank you, Crafty. Sounded amazing. So we shall move on to yourself, Chesto.
Yes.
And you have been in something rather different, not quite as commodious, no double beds here, but you've been with it for some time.
Yeah, so I spent the last 3 months with it, actually, and if yours is 8 metres, this thing's about 8 centimetres. This is the Ford Puma.
Right.
And just, I guess, a tiny bit of background first on the world of SUVs. There was once a time not so long ago when SUVs basically came in three sizes, small, medium, and large. But of course, the proliferation of SUVs across the board has caused us to create even more categories for it. So this is a small SUV, so small it can't even be classified as a small SUV. It's in the section below it, which we officially call light SUVs, which is like tiny little hatchbacks with a minuscule amount of extra ride height to justify.
Also reduced salt and a lighter taste.
That's correct.
It's a light SUV.
Slightly lower in sodium, if I'm
honest. That's right.
I was in the Ford Puma ST line, and I got to say, it's one of those vehicles that I really do think is unfairly overlooked in this category. So the light SUV category is basically dominated at the moment by the CX-3. To give you an example, in the first 2 months of 2021, 1,300 examples of the CX-3 were sold.
Next in the next is the Yaris Cross, which is only a fairly new model, as you know. They sold 541. Then the Hyundai Venue, 443. And then way down the line is the Ford Puma. Which sold around 200, in fact, less than 200.
Wow. And that's for the first 3 months?
First
2 months of the year.
Yeah, correct.
That's right. We haven't finished March yet.
No. So long story short, it's not a huge seller, and I really think unfairly so. It's not a perfect car by any stretch of the imagination. It's a tiny little three-cell engine, dual clutch gearbox. It can feel a bit jerky when you're driving it at slow speeds. But the thing I really love about this car is it is not in any way boring, and that is an allegation you really can level at a lot of cars in that segment, and in fact in the small SUV segment above it. It's not boring to look at. It looks cool and sporty and kind of swollen arches and bulges everywhere, and a bit like Crafty in a swimsuit, actually.
yeah
Bulges in all the right places.
Yeah, well, Crafty's latest nickname is Arnie.
Yeah, that's right.
I was just bulgy.
Yes, but perhaps even more important, it's not boring to drive. So many of these things do feel like an appliance on the road. This does not. It's really engaging. When you try to drive it slowly, it can be a bit annoying, but when you drive it with a bit of gusto, which is how I think it was engineered,
okay,
it's actually a really rewarding drive. The steering's great. The ride and handling's actually really good. The engine, despite being tiny, never feels pokey, and it kind of encourages you to get up it a little bit, which I don't know, it's really fun. Downsides? Well, the back seat is ridiculous. You cannot fit anything even approaching an adult human. Three across the back is impossible.
Right.
Dogs in there, Chester?
Dog was no problem. Very short legs on the Corgi, happily.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Yes. They're hardworking legs too. You know, for every human, Corgis, that's right. They've got to take a lot of steps.
Actually looks like it's hovering when it's going.
Yeah.
So I spent some time in the back seat, of course, to test it. I also squeezed some people I didn't like back there as well.
Good. Nice.
And the truth is that, like, even though your knees don't touch the seat in front, even though your head doesn't quite touch the roof line, there is this undeniable feeling of claustrophobia in the back, which isn't great. Yeah. The other question mark is it isn't cheap. So as you know, there's a lot of really affordable metal in the light SUV category. The Puma starts at about 30 grand, which is
which is
a lot of ask for a car in that segment. You get a lot of stuff, don't get me wrong, but still a lot of money to find. The one I had was about 32 and a half, and then it tops out with the ST Line V, I think. Anyway,
all right.
Tops out at about 35K. So in that segment, that's fairly expensive, considering, you know, you can get into a Venue, for example, for peanuts. So
yes.
So not cheap, not large, but it is not boring either.
It's interesting you mentioned the driver, you know, engagement aspect, Chesto, because the one we're not getting so far, but, you know, you never know, is the ST version of the Puma, which has been getting really positive reviews in other markets, but so far not for us.
Yeah, and look, it's that kind of SUV, and, you know, you have got to air quote the term SUV. We've spent so much time talking about the Land Cruiser, this ain't that.
Right.
But you can feel that it's kind of set up for that kind of performance. It's low to the ground. It feels like it's got a wheel at each corner. You know, all the things that don't make it a true SUV are the same things that would make it a pretty handy front drive sports car.
Gotcha. Yeah, gotcha. Okay, well, that's cool. And you were waving it goodbye. So three months have come to an end.
I've just waved it goodbye. I made sure I emptied the toilet tank on the way back. Well, I think the technical term is glove box. I'm not sure.
That's right. Oh, dear. Yes. Not normally a removable item, but that's
cool. Talk about ham water.
Yeah, that's right. But, like, you know, it's wireless charging and all this sort of mod cons you might expect. The only thing I don't like about it that always annoys me is that, in fact, there's a few quirks, as I said. It can feel a bit jerky. Back seat's tiny. Boot space actually isn't bad. But it's fabric seats, you know, and I do think that if I'm spending, you know, upwards of 32K on a car, I want some options on the seat coverings. I don't want fabric seats. I'll say pleather seats, or as they call it, vegan leather now. But fabric seats feels a bit cheap.
Vinyl. I remember when Mercedes-Benz, the name for its artificial leather, used to be MB Tex.
Yeah.
And Mercedes-Benz sent out a Christmas card asking people to donate for the fund to save the precious resources of wild MB Texes out there on the on the tundra that were, you know, the stocks were dwindling.
Exactly.
But, I mean, vinyl, synthetic leather, is just as tough and often looks just as good.
I think so.
Leather's increasingly becoming a controversial material. You know, which to upholster a car. Yeah.
When I first started in this business, people used to really turn their nose up at pleather seats. It was like it was a real cheap out thing. Yeah. And you can just imagine the look of joy on the automotive marketer's face when they realized they could call it vegan leather and charge more than actual leather.
That's right.
No, it's not great leather. Point. It's vegan leather.
Vegan leather.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Car shoppers, come in. I saw you coming. I saw you coming. All right. Well, that's great. Thank you, Chesto. I'll finish off with the Skoda Scala, which is the car I've been driving this week. It's the 110 TSI Monte Carlo, very exotic. A little roulette wheel. There's no roulette wheel.
I was about to say, Biscuit,
yeah. The dice was running, they were running hot. It's a 1.5-litre turbo 4, 110 kilowatts, 250 newton metres. So it's turbo, so that torque is available from just 1,500 revs up to 3,500. So you're getting peak torque in that sweet zone there. 7-speed dual clutch, it's front-wheel drive. So this Monte Carlo version is 33,390 drive away. So, you know, really you're talking about a $30,000 car that's been put on the road, no more to pay.
Yep.
I thought, as is typical with Skoda, it's a very thoughtful design, a lot of practical features, you know, the whole simply clever thing. Mm. But there's nets, you open up the cargo area and there are retaining nets everywhere. And that's just so handy, I've got to say, to help keep things under control. Capable, it rides nicely. It looks okay. That's always a subjective call. It has these angular lights and a pretty cool treatment of the rear glass over the hatch door where it just finishes in this very clean line. Mm-hmm. And the Monte Carlo treatment's a bit racy. You get some blacked out bits here and there. And the boot, aside from the nets, is pretty big. This Monte Carlo pack, it's 18s. You get the black pack, sports seats. It has this really big fixed glass roof, which is always lovely. LED headlights, you get dual zone climate, smart key, adaptive suspension. So lots of gear in there. Overall, though, at the end of the week with the car, I just felt kind of uninspired, is the kindest way to put it. The dual clutch could be a little more refined. It was a bit clunky, particularly at lower speeds. I'd say it's not bad. It's not good. It was just capable. So if that's what you're after, a lot of those very helpful, practical bits and pieces around the car, it's easy to live within that regard. But as a car, I just found it fairly plain would be my take on it.
I don't mean this to sound mean because it's not a bad thing, but there are certain cars that are like a pair of stilettos. And there are certain cars that are like a pair of sensible shoes.
You're right.
You've got to decide which end of that spectrum you're at.
Yes.
There is a counter.
I know where Crafty sits on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is a counter argument to all of that, though, that actually, in a long term, sensible shoes aren't bad.
They're more comfortable. And, yes, probably the better option.
Yeah.
So that's very well said. All right. Well, that's our garage. Thank you, guys. We'll quickly cover off feedback from last week. And we were talking about electric cars, and in fact, we'd plucked out the top five that we thought were the most interesting and worthy to talk about, coming here either this year or pretty soon after.
Very exciting.
It is. There's a lot on. Like, we had a laundry list of different cars, and we picked out the top ones. And G-Man said, thank you for talking about electric cars. You could sense his relief. Australia, we're so far behind the rest of the world. I'm scared of not getting any electric cars at all. But I think you can rest assured, G-Man, that there is going to be far greater choice in the very near term. Mal was talking about driving the e-tron, particularly with the camera side mirrors. Mm. And he was not a fan and made that plain in the podcast last week. And Hammer Rock says, look, come on, Mal. Everything new, for safety or not, can require a period of getting used to it. Especially if it's replacing something we've been using pretty much unchanged for a century or more. So that's interesting. And he talked about, you know, when seatbelts were made mandatory, he wasn't necessarily a part of that.
Sorry? 2 second counter argument. Hammer, you know I love you. Your feedback's always more than welcome. But on this, I'm 100% with Mal. I remember the first time I drove, was it the Velar or the Evoque maybe from the Range Rover when they had done away with the reversing mirror and replaced it with a camera?
Yep.
It's a great idea, and in theory, it should work wonderfully, but the tech just isn't fast enough yet. It's not a true live representation. And when, when you're reversing into a spot, for example, or you're about to change lanes, you really need that to be a live display of what's happening out the window. There can be no lag. And at the moment, I just don't think the tech's there.
All right. That's very good. I mean, the analogy Hammer made in terms of adoption was seatbelts. And I'm with him. I do remember, I did just a bit of online digging, and it reminded me that seatbelts in Australia became mandatory, first of all, in Victoria in 1970. And then within around 12 months, every state and territory had followed. But I reckon the mistake that was made at that point actually was that front seatbelts were made mandatory, but not in the rear. And that set up this kind of psychology where people thought that it was more important to wear your seatbelts in the front than the back. Oh, it's okay. We're in the back, which was a bit of a bummer. And I do remember giving my brother a set of seatbelts for his birthday, and he looked at me as if I'd stabbed him, because, you know, what are you doing to me? You're taking away my freedom.
I'm with him. That is an ordinary present. That's the equivalent of giving your wife a new iron or something. It's not going to be well received.
Mate, I was caring about his safety and his well-being. Anyway, so thank you, Hammer. Fair call and good feedback, Chesto. He also added in that when he first saw a photo of the Ioniq 5 Hyundai EV, he absolutely thought it was a Golf concept, that the resemblance is uncanny. And I'm not sure whether he had tongue-in-cheek, as in Hyundai may have taken some inspiration from the Golf, or whether it is genuinely uncanny. But I think he's right. It does have overtones of Volkswagen about it. And John Paul Cavellan finishes it off with a dig at Mal. Mal had driven the e-tron, and he gave us chapter and verse on it. And John Paul says, what's going on with Malcolm's review of the Audi e-tron? I thought I was listening to a thank you speech at the Logies. I didn't know when we were going to get to the point. I could have recharged my Tesla within that time.
Jeez.
He's having a red hot go at Mal. But Mal has never met a fact that he doesn't like. No. So he wanted to make sure that everybody knew everything about his experience with that car. So, but thank you for your feedback, John Paul. And now, talking about people who are deserving of awards, it's time for Muskwatch.
Muskwatch.
Right. So, first of all, some of you may have heard of this thing called an NFT. Now, NFTs are a kind of an online, a digital asset, and it stands for non-fungible tokens. And they're authenticated by blockchain, which certifies their originality and ownership. It's another world. I am not part of it.
Don't know what you're talking about, JC.
Yeah, okay, let's move on. Apparently their popularity has exploded during the pandemic as people have just got all this time to kill and they've jumped online. And they're spending enormous sums of money on these things. So anyway, Elon has made this animation and a song, and he's gone on Twitter and said, I'm selling this song about NFTs as an NFT. And it's just this shite piece of techno junk music with an animation. And then he's followed up later on saying, actually, doesn't feel quite right selling this, we'll pass. So as I mentioned earlier in the show, according to Reuters, his title now at Tesla is Techno King of Tesla. And they've made the finance chief, Zachary Kirkhorn, master of coin, because they've been buying such large amounts of cryptocurrency. It's actually a reasonably big part of the Tesla business is all of this crypto stuff. And to give you an idea of the scale of this NFT, a buyer of a US $70 million, so that's about 90 million Australian dollars, digital only artwork was named last week by auction house Christie's as a crypto asset investor who goes by the pseudonym Meta Coven. So this thing that he bought for 90 million Australian dollars is a kind of collage work online by this guy called Beeple. And it's just each day this guy had a project where he created a different artwork and posted it up. And now this guy's bought it for $90 million.
Thank you, Moses.
Unbelievable. But anyway,
what are we doing wrong?
I don't know. So when Elon had this really weird animation up for sale, Kane came in and said, I offer you two cups of coffee and an off-road ride in my 1995 Bronco. It actually included a picture of his Bronco. So I thought that was a pretty solid offer.
Yeah.
And then Have Aliens Arrive said, I'm selling the reversed version of Elon's song, he's selling about NFTs as an NFT. And then Budget Blast said, I'm selling a screenshot of someone's reverse version NFT of Elon Musk's song about NFTs as an NFT, as an NFT. Oh. So it's getting some traction, but people are also taking the mickey out of it, which I think is well-deserved.
The scariest thing about all of that, though, mate, is all this talk of NFTs and blockchains and all that sort of stuff doesn't go away soon. I'm actually going to have to learn what they all are.
Yeah.
I'm not looking forward to it.
That's right. Now,
can we wrap this up so I can go do an NFT, whatever that is, and get a couple of mil?
Attach the blockchain to your engine in the garage. That's the only blockchain I know.
That's right, yeah.
Now, surprise, surprise, Elon Musk has been sued and it's over tweeting in violation of this deal that he made a couple of years ago with the Securities and Exchange Commission in the States about the tweets that he was putting out there materially affecting the share price of Tesla. So he was instructed at the time, you might remember it was, I'm taking the company private, you know, and funding secured and all that stuff. And it absolutely was playing with the share price of Tesla. And the SEC said, you can't do that anymore. And in fact, you're going to have to pay, Tesla's got to pay $20 million. You've got to pay $20 million. You can't be chairman anymore. And you have to have every tweet that you send out vetted by a legal panel to make sure that it's not going to impact the share price of the company. And this person who sued him has said that has absolutely not happened. He's still sending out tweets that shift the share price massively. He cited one example where recently Elon said that he thought that the share price of Tesla was overpriced. And that tweet alone destroyed almost $14 billion of Tesla's market capitalization in a single day.
I remember that tweet and I thought the same thing. How is this possible?
How is he getting away with it? So the really telling point is, this story, I must say, where were we? Came from, I should credit it. We'll put it up on the video for people on who are watching us or via the video. Musk might have a hard time winning over the Delaware Chancery Court. This is where the case is being heard. A Bloomberg Law senior legal analyst said, with all the chances that Musk has been given, it is quite possible that the Chancery Court will have little patience with his latest tweeting adventures. Yeah. So it could be one time where he actually gets another pretty decent slap over the wrist. It'll be really interesting to see where that goes. Yeah. So in terms of the share price, it's $701 and that's up about $33, $34 from last week. It's been pretty stable all week as well. And Forbes says, had a story saying why Tesla stock looks set to rally further. So as it really went down, and that was partially because the whole share market went down, particularly in the US, but also people were moving out of pandemic mode where they were looking for high growth, pretty volatile stocks to make a quick buck. Now that America is getting vaccinated and maybe starting to come out of that, they're going for your more stable, more conservative options. And there was a bit of an overcorrection. The Tesla stock went down. Now it seems to be coming back. So Forbes says price rises are a signal of more confidence in demand for the product for Teslas. And Tesla will have new plants in Texas and Berlin this year to meet that demand.
Yep.
The stock is 20% below where it's been on these recent highs. So it may still well be overvalued, but it might come back. President Biden has an agenda about, you know, that potentially benefits EV players. And he's had some market share gains in China with Tesla after being on kind of shaky ground. But all that could lead to a rise. So there you go.
Interesting. I've made this point before, JC, but if we had only just bought some Tesla shares way back when we first started talking about them, we'd all have one of Crafty's motorhomes.
What was that? What was that movie where the people had gone into their bunker during the Cold War in the 1950s and somehow managed to live there forever and then came out, you know, at the turn of the century and they had IBM shares and all these things that had gone through the roof? And they just had them in their side drawer.
I wasn't going to miss out on IBM shares. No, not. I missed out on the first round, so that's why I sunk all my money into Blockbuster. I'm waiting for that.
That's right. Exactly right. Yeah, I think there's one. Isn't there a movie made about the last Blockbuster store? I think there's a.
Yeah,
movie
I think there's a doco about it. Yeah.
And we still have one Video Easy. I think in Perth. I think West Australia.
That's right. I think I forget the movie. I think it was called Other People's Money. And there was Danny DeVito, who was acquiring some company. He talked about buggy whips.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that? Everyone had horses. And then when you're the last buggy whip manufacturer, you become the niche one and everyone wants your product. So if you can hang in there long enough.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe you've got a business. Anyway, look, with that, we have reached the finish line. And I want to say thank you, Crafty.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And thank you, Chester.
Thanks, Chester. Yeah.
Thank you, everyone.
And thanks to our chief of chatting, vibe manager, and corporate wizard, Mr. Pritchard, for his otherworldly production processes. This week, he's wearing a T-shirt saying, "I have CDO. It's like OCD, but all the letters are in alphabetical order like they should be." He's wearing Dogecoin pants and corn shoes.
Oh,
yeah, exceptional. Yeah.
It's a fetching combination.
It is a fetching combination.
He always looks lovely. He's always the best dressed of all.
That's a great word for it too, Crafty. Lovely. Yeah, he looks lovely.
Yeah. He does.
Let us know your thoughts. You can find Cars Guide on Facebook and Instagram or email us at comments@carsguide.com.au. Love to hear from you. If you're an Apple Podcast listener, please rate and review us. Remember, you can normally watch us on YouTube and we'll be back there soon. But before we go, a young bloke's listening to the radio in the car with his father. "Dad, what music did you like growing up?" He says, "I was a huge fan of Led Zeppelin," the father replies. "Who?" the son asks. "Yeah," Dad responds, "I like them too."
Goodness me.
Oh, God. Right.
Good idea. Thank you, everyone.